There were a lot of changes going on in healthcare, just as there are today, and started to see that the decisions that were being made and the way healthcare was going was being done by people who really didn't understand healthcare, especially from the physician point of view. And the physicians were getting squeezed and felt like they didn't have much of a say, but really didn't know how to go about it and had no interest or skill in doing it. And it was something that I enjoyed and felt like there was a definite need for physicians to be at the table. And that was one of the sayings of our lobbyist: if you're not at the table, you're on it.
This episode, we learn from Dr. Adam Solomon, the Chief Medical Officer for the Memorial Care Medical Foundation, which is a part of the larger Memorial Care health system in Southern California. Zach and I connect with Dr. Solomon and learn quite a bit about how an IPA works, about accountable care, and how physician group works within a larger health system. Dr. Adam Solomon teaches us quite a bit in today's episode, and it was really eye-opening with the inner workings of a medical group. I hope you enjoy today's show, and if you'd like to connect with Zach or I, feel free to reach out to Zach at PopHealthZach or at GavinPopHealth, and we encourage you to please leave a review on Stitcher or iTunes. Thanks so much, and enjoy the show. Dr. Solomon, tell us something about you that might surprise even your colleagues or our audience, maybe something outside of the workplace.
Oh, interesting. Well, I like to cook. And for the entirety of my marriage and also the growth of my children, every night, assuming I didn't have call and have to go to the hospital, I would get home and I'm the one who makes dinner for the family. So we do tend to eat pretty late. It's not unusual to have dinner 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. And it is somewhat eclectic. While other families may have more mundane food for dinner, we might have lamb Rogan Josh or pad thai.
So lamb, can you say that second part again? Forgive me, I guess I'm a pretty mundane eater here.
Lamb Rogan Josh, it's a red cooked lamb. It's in a red curry sauce.
Okay. Did you go to culinary school, or where did you pick up your cooking skills?
No, I've just always liked to eat. And in college, discovered that I couldn't afford to eat the kind of food that I like to have. And so I started just cooking and finding recipes for things that I enjoyed. And then once I got married to my wife, in between work and kids, time was tight. And I'd get home at the end of the day and we'd try to figure out what to have for dinner and wouldn't have a recipe picked, wouldn't have the ingredients, and would end up eating something fast. And we both noticed we were gaining weight quickly. Yeah. And so we picked a series of recipes that we really enjoyed, and each week we'll pull out the recipes for the week, and my wife will shop, get the ingredients, and I get home at night, and I know what I'm going to cook. I know the ingredients are there, and we get to enjoy a delicious meal every night.
All right. Well, good for you.
Do you have a go-to or a specialty if you're cooking, say, for other people, or do you have one that's like your signature dish?
It tends to vary. My pad thai actually comes out very good. Okay. So it was one of those dishes that when we eat out, sometimes we'll eat in a Thai restaurant, my kids will order pad thai, and then every time it's, Dad, this is not as good as your pad thai.
Now, on a scale, I know that those restaurants, they say 1 to 10 spicy level. What's your spicy level?
So that's been actually very fun. I enjoyed some spiciness. I don't like it so hot that it's a fight to take the next bite.
Yeah.
But when the kids were smaller, they really were intolerant of anything spicy. And now they've both kind of gotten used to it. So we're more like the 6-7 level spiciness.
Nice.
So it's good.
Great. So shifting away from the personal side and back into healthcare, tell us a little bit about, you mentioned school, for example. Tell us where you went to school and how you eventually got into healthcare.
So to get into healthcare, I had decided a variety of reasons when I was small that I was going to be a doctor. Okay. There's some history in my family, my grandfather passing away from cancer, that made me feel like being a doctor would be a great job to have. And so through high school, that had already been decided, going to college, I knew whatever degree I'm getting, that is the goal is to get into medical school. So I went to University of Maryland, got an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's in science in biochemistry.
Okay.
And then subsequently went to the University of Maryland at Baltimore, got my medical degree. I did my residency in internal medicine at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. And then after that, I started working in practice with a group in Oregon.
So let me backtrack a little bit. Where were you born and raised?
So I was actually born in New York and then moved to Maryland with my family when I was 12 years old.
Okay.
So most of my growing years were spent in Maryland. I went to junior high, high school, and then college and medical school all in Maryland.
Okay. Well, we're going to be in NFL season now. So who's your team?
Well, I get a, you know, still love the Ravens, so.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
In all of your culinary expertise, do you also do some of the Maryland specialties, crab cakes, things like that?
Yeah, and actually when it was funny when I first got married, and my wife's mom, who hopefully will not be listening to this, is not the best cook. Yeah. And early on in our marriage, I said, I'm going to make some crab cakes, so I miss having crab cakes. And my wife is like, I hate crab cakes. Don't make crab cakes. I said, how could you hate them? They're so delicious. And she said, they're fried and they're greasy, they're terrible. And I said, who fries crab cakes? You broil the crab cakes, they're delicious. And so, yeah, so make crab cakes, they're broiled.
All right. Nice. I've been out to Baltimore and they always say, go to the Inner Harbor and get crab cakes. But I'm not a seafood guy, so I guess I'm missing out here.
Yeah, it's a great tradition. Or just crab. And generally, you sit at a table covered with newspapers and they'll take this bushel of crabs and just dump them out on the table. And
oh, yeah.
You start grabbing them with the beer and... little by little, your hands are covered with the Old Bay spice. It's delicious.
Yes, I bet. For most of you. So Maryland, and you go out to medical school out in Utah. And how did you end up out here in California and eventually going from a practicing physician to leading a foundation or a medical group?
That is a somewhat longer story. So when I started practice in Oregon, I joined a group that had been there since 1903.
Wow.
And my initial plan really was, I'm a doctor, I've worked my whole life to do this, and this is what I'm going to do for the next 35 years, and then I'll retire. And I literally glued my name tag to the door of my office because I figured that's it, I'm not going anywhere else. And then over the course of the next few years, I was in a group of about 10 physicians, made a couple of financial decisions that affected me negatively, we'll put it nicely. And decided I needed to get a little bit more involved with the management running of the group, and started to bring together some people to say, where are we going to be in 5 years? What is our plan? And we didn't have one, so helped work through, developed a three-year plan, a five-year plan, and looked into the growth of the group and how the finances were done. And the physician that had been the managing partner of the group for the prior 9 years decided that he was not going to continue in that position. And so I decided to run and try to become managing partner. Had a little resistance because I was the new guy in the block. I'd only been there about 3 years, but they voted me in and I became managing partner of the group. Realized that a lot of our finances were tied to how well our Independent Physician Association, or IPA, was doing. And so figured I need to get involved there. Again, getting a board seat on the IPA, little resistance, new guy in town. What does he know? We've got a lot of experienced physicians. Was able to wear them down and got onto the board of the IPA, started to gain a little experience there, and eventually became president of the IPA. Our IPA started a Medicare Advantage plan, was involved on that. We started a political action committee.
Wow.
So I was involved in that.
And this is all in Oregon?
This is all in Oregon, okay. In Salem. So we were right in the capital of Oregon, where we had the legislators right nearby.
Yeah.
And that experience, and at the time... this was back in the mid-2000s. There were a lot of changes going on in healthcare, just as there are today, and started to see that the decisions that were being made and the way healthcare was going was being done by people who really didn't understand healthcare, especially right. From the physician point of view. And the physicians were getting squeezed and felt like they didn't have much of a say, but really didn't know how to go about it and had no interest or skill in doing it. And it was something that I enjoyed and felt like there was a definite need for physicians to be at the table. And there was one of the sayings of our lobbyist, if you're not at the table, you're on it.
Nice.
And that truly was the way things were going. And so I was at a crossroads because I was spending a lot of my time doing clinical medicine and a fair amount of time doing all the administrative work. And I'm somewhat of a perfectionist and feel like I need to do what I'm doing well.
Yeah.
And each thing would interrupt each other. I would be working with my administrator for my clinic, and then I'd get a call from the hospital with a patient in the ICU that I needed to go see, and I'd have to just drop everything and go, or vice versa. So I thought, let me get a little further education in this. It won't hurt for me to have it, and then I can decide what I want to do. So I signed up for the Master's in Medical Management program at USC, which is an excellent program for leadership in medical management. And within the so most of it is online.
Okay.
They send you books to read and articles to read. There's communication online, but there are 4 weeks where you have to be on campus and interact with the other students and also get lectures. And within that first week, the lectures were phenomenal. The other students were amazing from across the country. And I realized I really love doing this. Yeah. I think I'm good at it. And there's a significant need for someone to be a spokesman for physicians as things continue to transition in healthcare. And that was when I made the decision that I want to go into the administrative side of medicine. So then I started looking for a job. And Oregon, the whole state has about 3 million people. My group at the time had grown and was probably the third or maybe fourth largest group in the state. And there were not a lot of positions available. I spoke to some of the other organizations and they were fully established. So I started looking elsewhere. Southern California really was a place that I felt like the movement towards the management of populations had been well in advance of where it was elsewhere. And so, and there was opportunity here. And also looking in the Northwest, my wife had said, I've had enough of the gray and the rain.
Oh, yeah.
So made a decision to come down here and had an opportunity in Los Angeles that I went to.
That's an interesting point too, because we get to talk to a lot of people who work here in Southern California. Do you still feel like Southern California is kind of on the breaking edge of things in the healthcare space?
Absolutely. As I've progressed along in my journey here and been speaking to organizations across the country, the things that have been in effect in California for years is new to everyone else.
Yeah.
Or they said, well, we were there 20, 30 years ago. We kind of started doing that and it didn't really work out so well. So we stopped and now it's gone. But right. It's stayed here. It's thrived here. And so a lot of the culture, the things that we just take for granted in Southern California, other parts of the country are just turning back to it and trying to figure out how to make it work.
Sure.
So now you moved to LA and then you eventually came over to the Memorial Care Foundation. And tell us the term foundation. Like when I think of that, or other people may think it means different things. Tell us about maybe your role here, but what does Memorial Care Medical Foundation mean exactly?
So the state of California has a law that prohibits the corporate practice of medicine. So in most other states, I think there are 6 states that have a similar law, although most of them don't enforce it. In most other states, you'll have hospitals will directly employ physicians.
Okay.
And in California, that is illegal. It can't happen. So some hospital systems, if they're nonprofit, if they have a mission that involves research, education, then they can start a foundation if they have 40 different physicians of 10 different specialties that are going to provide education and research. And Memorial Care, the health system, which was comprised of just hospitals, realized that the need for management of population health was growing and more things were going to be taken care of outside of the hospital walls. And the way to do that is to have an integrated system that includes physicians and other outpatient services. And so they started the foundation and they were able to do that because they did have enough physicians, both from the specialty side as well as from the numbers of physicians. At the time, this is back in 2011, the NIDUS that they used was mostly from Bristol Park Physicians, which is a medical group that has been in Orange County and was just about to celebrate their 50th anniversary. That group, along with some other physicians, some specialists in Long Beach, another group of prompt care, urgent care, and primary care physicians all came together and started the medical foundation to support the population health goals of the system.
And tell us, what is the system?
So Memorial Care Health System is comprised of 5 hospitals. In Long Beach in southern Los Angeles County, we have Long Beach Memorial Medical Center, Miller Women's and Children's Medical Center, Community Hospital of Long Beach. And then in Fountain Valley, which is more mid-coast in Orange County, is Orange Coast Memorial. And in Laguna Hills, which is closer to southern Orange County, is Saddleback Memorial Health Center.
And so how does the foundation relate with or work with the Memorial Care Health System?
They're separate entities, but they are related, like in a way, brother and sister. So the foundation is where we have our... So professional service agreements with our medical group, Memorial Care Medical Group, as well as our Independent Physicians Association, Greater Newport Physicians, otherwise known as an IPA. Those contracts for the management of those patients come through the foundation. The foundation is the place that supports the management of those patients for both the medical group and the IPA. But the foundation's role is slightly different between those two organizations. So for the IPA, the foundation will support those contracts and the management for performance of those contracts. On the medical group side, the professional services agreement enforces our support of those physicians. So the physicians provide medical services, and in exchange for that, the foundation provides the offices and the staff, the equipment, gives them all the tools that they need to practice their craft.
And you had mentioned a term earlier, I think one that gets thrown around a lot, but maybe it's one of those things that people don't necessarily always admit, whether they fully understand it or not. You had mentioned Medicare Advantage plans. Can you just give an elevator speech of what, or tell the audience what the Medicare Advantage plan means?
Sure. So Medicare, Medicare is a government program for insurance for seniors or people who are disabled or have kidney failure. There were originally Part A and Part B for Medicare. Part A would cover institutional costs, things like the hospital, for example, and then Part B is professional costs. They decided to wrap those together and have what they call Medicare Part C, and which is what we call Medicare Advantage, where an independent health plan would get a payment for the population that is enrolled with them, and then that health plan is responsible for the management of those patients under that fixed monthly amount that they receive from the government.
Capitated rate, basically.
The capitated rate to the health plan.
Right.
And they are responsible for not just providing the services, but providing quality. And over the last several years, Medicare has implemented what they call star ratings, which will pertain to the quality and experience that the patients will have with that health plan. In many states, that the health plan will then just pay the physician's fee for service. But in California, in Southern California, where we've had this history of managed care, very frequently that payment from the health plan to the physician group will be, again, another capitated or bundled payment per member per month. So the medical group is now responsible for the management of those lives, right, as well as all of the quality metrics and capturing their risk, the acuity, how sick that population is. All of that will be reflected back to the health plan when they provide their data back to the government.
So for Medicare Advantage plans, are the medical groups that take on those plans, are they automatically at full risk for all of those patients, or are there varying levels of risk for them with that patient population?
So it can vary. So again, there are still, in the majority of the country, Medicare Advantage is still paying fee for service. So there is no risk to the medical groups or physicians that are getting paid. In Southern California, we have a lot of groups that will take full risk, where they get the capitated payment that will cover both the institutional side as well as the professional side. And there are some where they'll have what they call shared risk, where the group may take risk for the professional side, and the institutional side is still paid for by the health plan. For patients, it's a way of packaging all that management together and having more services, usually at a lower premium than they would get if they were paying for a Medicare plan with a supplement.
Sure. And so for your patient population, how does it break down? Is it a lot of Medicare or Medicare Advantage? Is it mostly commercial? What kind of patient population do you manage?
So our population is pretty mixed, and it also will vary somewhat on where you are in the county. As you travel further north, we have slightly lower managed care numbers in our offices and slightly higher PPO fee-for-service, and in the southern county, it's much more managed care-centric. For both our medical group as well as for Greater Newport Physicians, we have about 50,000 commercial lives that we are at professional risk for. So that's about 100,000 right there. And then for Medicare Advantage, we have 20,000 Medicare Advantage lives for Greater Newport Physicians and about 10,000 for Memorial Care Medical Group. Yeah. So total about 150,000,
wow,
where we're at full risk for those lives.
Which is a pretty large number, right? I mean, just compared to other hospital systems that we've spoken with, that is a large number of full risk patients.
It is. It is a decent number of risk patients. And with risk, numbers really help because you spread that risk over a larger base, and it helps to reduce some of the variability that you have. It also helps you to have more processes and procedures that you can manage patients in the same manner throughout. In addition, we have a very large population of PPO, fee-for-service patients, and historically, those patients, they're free to go where they want, so they manage their own care. And for both Medicare and for employers, who are ultimately generally the payers for the commercial side, the expenses still tend to be high because their care is unmanaged. Patients will go and seek out a lot of care. And because the physicians are getting paid on a per-click basis, each service that they provide gives them additional revenue, sometimes utilization is higher.
Sure.
And so they've been transitioning to what they'll call ACO, or Accountable Care Organizations. Most of them are PPO. Some of them are still HMO. But in a PPO ACO, the organization that is signed up for this ACO has some financial risk for the management of that population. So even though the patients are still free to go and see whichever physician that they want to, there is this support mechanism where the organization can get data from the health plan and can help identify patients that may need some assistance, whether they recognize it initially or not, and reach out to them and support them and offer them additional services that they may not get otherwise, to help improve their outcomes, help direct them to some of the better physicians or surgeons in the community. It is hard to get that information. A lot of people will go onto Yelp or Best Doctors or different websites like right. that. But you are somewhat at risk to the whims of society. You know, people yeah. who tends to go on and rank their physician, it's either the patient who just had a bad experience is just going to rail on the physician for whatever reason, or those that, you know, the unusual one who just had such an incredible experience, they just feel driven to put something down.
Right.
Most often they're going to tend to the negative just because that's just the way people are traditionally driven to go spend their time to put information on Yelp right. or so forth.
Right.
But physicians over time, as you have this relationship with specialists, you get to see how well, you know, how happy are the patients that come back? How often do patients get surgeries that you think maybe that was a little bit aggressive? Maybe they didn't need that, or other workups that they, you know, maybe they needed, maybe they didn't need. Was the communication good? How accessible was the physician? And as you get to see that, you can use that to help guide patients to say, this is who I tend to send patients to. This is who I would probably send my family member to because I know what kind of work that they provide.
Right.
Very good. I had a question for you, Dr. Solomon. You mentioned professional services. Many in our audience may know what that term means, but there may be others who don't. Can you define when you say professional services? How does that, what does that mean exactly?
So those buckets that I talked about earlier in Medicare where they divide things, it's a similar division in the commercial world. So when you see a provider, a physician in general, but it could be an advanced health practitioner like a nurse practitioner or a PA, even radiological services if you go to an outpatient center and get x-rays. Things that don't occur in a hospital in general fall under that professional services bucket.
Great.
So you had also mentioned IPAs. And how has that changed over the years? How have those groups really changed as the healthcare ecosystem has changed?
Well, IPAs, so if you think about what the term means, Independent Physicians Association, these are a collection of physicians in private practice, and it is somewhat more towards what we would historically think of as the doctor Welby type in, you know, in an independent practice, a physician or maybe a couple of physicians in an office with a few assistants, and they just manage the patients that come in there. But in order to manage a population and to help have access to these managed care contracts where there are quality metrics or outcome metrics that are required, you need a different type of infrastructure that is difficult to have in just a solitary office. So by joining together and having a more centralized structure, then you have these association of these independent physicians or IPA. Those evolved initially for this HMO type of business and continue to manage those patients. But with this move from HMO business to PPO business, and also with the movement that Medicare has been making to these bundled payments and other population health initiatives under a law that was recently passed with the acronym MACRA. In order for those physicians to have the infrastructure to manage and do well under those systems, they need to have an organizational structure that they can get from the IPA affiliation.
Yeah, and we hear a lot about as things change, the challenges. Well, quick plug, really quickly, if anybody wants to know a little bit more about MACRA, Gavin and I actually sat down with Dr. Ashby Wolf, the chief medical officer for this region of CMS, and she spoke about MACRA for the entire episode, so I would invite you to go and check that out. But on the one thing that we hear a lot when we talk to especially hospital or medical group leadership is about getting buy-in throughout the system, particularly starting with the physicians at the top. How do you get buy-in in your organization here?
Well, for our central organization, the health system itself, it's been, I hate to say, relatively easy because it comes from the top. So one of the things, and going, this goes back to what we discussed earlier with the starting of the foundation, is that our president CEO, our president, Barry Arbuckle, is a believer in this population health movement and recognized that things were going to be moving outside of the hospital walls and has helped to make, to drive this change to bring in the foundation and have the foundation bring in outpatient imaging instead of doing imaging at the hospital, which is more expensive, bringing in surgery centers. Surgery in a surgery center, not only is it more convenient for the patient, the physician, it is far less expensive. And so from the top, that movement has been there. A lot of other health systems, because the pay differential between services provided in a hospital setting and in an outpatient setting are so great, most hospital systems do not want to give up that revenue. And they may talk the game of saying, yes, it's we need to watch costs and we need to be conscientious of utilization. The reason they affiliate with medical groups and physicians is to drive more of that care into their health system and raise the costs.
Right.
Or at least to garner more of the costs for themselves, not necessarily to raise costs, but to bring it into their own organization. And we've made the conscientious decision to actually do the opposite, which is a painful step to make,
Yeah. But
it's the right thing to do.
And long term, you'll win.
Correct. And so that is the reason why our PPO ACO business has been growing rapidly. I didn't give you some numbers earlier. We were talking about our risk, our HMO lives.
Right.
But we now have we have over 100,000 ACO lives now. 4 years ago, we had zero.
Wow.
And so it won't take too long till our at-risk ACO population has eclipsed our HMO population.
Yeah. And you had also mentioned some of the changes with bundles. We might have a little bit more information by the time this episode comes out. But as we're recording, we just recently in the last few weeks have gotten kind of the definitive announcements that some of the mandatory bundles are going to be rolled back. Cardiac's going to be taken away. Some of the MSAs are going to be drawn back for the original mandatory bundles. As you're leading an organization, we like to hear different perspectives on this. How do you lead an organization forward when you have to integrate to those things or adapt to those things, but you don't necessarily know what the landscape is going to look like, you know, a year down the road, 5 years down the road?
Yeah, so unfortunately, that has been the history of healthcare the last several years, is that you just don't know what is going to happen in the near future. Things are evolving very quickly in all aspects of healthcare. Bundles for us end up being slightly easier because it matches with the organizational goals of managing costs, improving efficiency. And also, even though we have the foundation, so we do have a medical group, we do have an IPA, the system of hospitals still has far more physicians in the community that see our hospitals as their hub of performance where they do their work. And we want to support them as well. So the system had made the decision to voluntarily sign up for orthopedic and cardiac bundles. And so this change doesn't actually affect us because we are in the voluntary bundle. We made that decision prior to it becoming mandatory.
And I think a lot of people forget that folks, and including myself, sometimes I have to be reminded that a lot of groups have voluntarily stepped in. Sometimes there's kicking and screaming, but like you said, Dr. Solomon, you guys voluntarily stepped in and we'll continue to see those bundle payments. So we haven't had a CMO on our show before. And when I think physician, I think your client is the patient, but that's not the case necessarily with you and your role. Tell us who your client is.
That is an interesting question. And I'll preface it by saying the title itself, CMO, and actually even the title medical director, you'll see both of those. And it means a lot, but it doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
So if you go from one organization to the next organization, you can have either one of those titles and have two different physicians with completely different job descriptions on what they're responsible for. So in this organization, the chief medical officer reports directly to the CEO of the foundation. So my boss is Dr. Mark Schaefer, who's our CEO of the foundation. And reporting to me, I have essentially five different people. One is the vice president of medical management. And the Department of Medical Management is where we manage our HMO lives. So doing prior authorization, case management, concurrent review, monitoring, managing our patients in the hospital and their transitions out. I also oversee our Department of Clinical Pharmacy and Performance Improvement. So we have 11 pharmacists, and they are actually in our organization in an unusual situation. We've made them responsible for our diabetes clinic, for example. And so for some of our specialty management clinics, we have pharmacists that run them. And so how well we manage diabetes and also our post-discharge clinic, anticoagulation clinic, all of those things will roll up to me. The quality aspect that we have for not just our HMO lives, but also our ACO lives, those all will come in. Each contract that we have may have different quality metrics. I'll get back to that in a minute when I finish this question. In addition, so the medical director over quality reports to me, and then our inpatient medical director. So all of that clinical side comes to me, but I also oversee the medical director who is the senior medical director over our IPA and the senior medical director over our medical group. But the question you asked really was, who's my client? And I guess ultimately, I see myself as responsible for the performance of the management of our patients. And even though I'm not directly responsible for the individual care of any patients, it is to oversee the processes, protocols, and people that help to keep our population healthy, hit our quality metrics, improve the experience that those patients have, and reduce the costs overall. In general, quality medical care results in lower costs over time.
So you mentioned quality medical care. We've talked a lot about care outside the walls of the hospital. So the foundation, your IPA side, Greater Newport Physicians, the hospitals, you guys all work with other entities to provide the care, like home health companies, DME companies. So can you tell me from the foundation's perspective how those companies support you, how you seek them out, how you work with them?
So neither the IPA or the medical group can provide all services. And so it could be either a home health organization, or it could be a skilled nursing facility, or it could just be a specialist. Those things need to be contracted out. And so our IPA or our medical group will find organizations or providers from those different areas that we need the support, and we'll contract with them to provide those services for us. And we'll tend to have a smaller network that we use because, again, just like I mentioned before, with helping the PPO patients identify who are the quality providers, we, for our own patients, want to identify who are the ones that we really want to work with, because they are responsive, they show up when they're supposed to, they provide good service, they communicate well with our patients. The quality of the services that they provide are what we want. And that's where we're going to tend to have our contracts and direct the care of our patients.
Great. And one of the companies that I referenced and you touched on as well is home health. So we're seeing a lot of conversation over the years and a lot of care shifting more into the home. There's things like house call doctor groups out there. And I was curious, with your foundation, is more care shifting to the home from your perspective as well? I know there's still a need for hospitals and SNFs and things like that, but tell us a little bit about how you're seeing within your population care shift to the home.
Yeah, and I think actually the bundled payments are one of the best examples of that. When you look at the bundled payment, the trigger is a hospital procedure. Depending on which bundle you're in, it could be knee replacement or cardiac procedure. But frequently, historically, after an orthopedic procedure, patients ended up in a skilled nursing facility when they needed some aggressive physical therapy, but they didn't need it for the extent of time that patients usually end up in a skilled nursing facility. The payments to the hospital for the service is limited because Medicare designs how much money they're going to pay for the hospital care. You could have extra costs if the patients get readmitted, but our readmission rates had been good. The professional services are also preordained on what they're going to pay. But it's that post-acute care. What happens after the patient leaves the hospital? Where do they go? That's where the expenses can lie. So looking at which skilled facilities you would use if you're going to use them, but it's much more cost-effective, and most patients generally do better if they go directly home and then immediately get support from home physical therapy and any other home assessments, or if they're even they're able to do it even better, to be home but also be able to just get to outpatient physical therapy where they have, you know, advanced equipment that they may not be able to bring into the home. So there's the savings that they're getting in the bundled payments, for the most part, are these post-acute costs, which are as great, if not greater, than the costs that are incurred in the hospitalization itself. So the hip surgery is expensive, but that post-acute period of time, historically, is just as much money, if not more.
And are you seeing within your organization a larger percent go directly home versus maybe a skilled nursing or...
Yeah, and that's been the big shift for us. And so each year that we've been in the bundle, we were able to get some money that we could then share with the physicians that were participating in the bundle. And that savings has come from post-acute, either because we've reduced the number of patients that go to a skilled facility after they're discharged, or we've been able to shorten their stay in the skilled facility. But most of them, we are trying to get them into a home environment. And a lot of that comes from just the prep work ahead of time, the expectations that people have when they come in before the procedure.
Absolutely.
Just to get them ready to think about, you know, when this is over, you're going to go home. That's the expectation. And these are the services that you'll likely need and what we can do to help support you.
Very good. So we're starting to see more health systems. So Memorial Care, you have your Memorial Health System has the acute inpatient settings. You have the foundation, IPA. Has Memorial Care looked at getting in the insurance business? Or I know I've heard of things like Vivity where you're connected well with Anthem. So tell us about that, or just about the insurance business.
So two things on that, I guess. Yeah. One is we actually have an insurance plan.
Okay.
So part of the Memorial Care Health System is the Seaside Health Plan. It came into the foundation. Actually, it came into the system, not the foundation. It came into the system in, I think, 2011.
Okay.
And it's a small plan. For the most part, it's what you would call a plan to plan. So a health plan would use Seaside to provide a network of providers, mostly for Medi-Cal or Medicaid patients. We expanded it very slightly. It has a commercial license, and many of the physicians in the medical group are actually insured through Seaside Health Plan. But there is a concern that if we were to grow Seaside, it would look like it was in competition with the health plans that we cooperate with on a daily basis. So we don't want to look like we're threatening their work and be in direct competition as they're bringing lives to us. And okay. So we have not really grown Seaside. Vivity is an interesting entity and really unusual across the country, where seven major health systems got together with Anthem Blue Cross of California and started, in essence, a health plan where all eight are equal owners in this health plan. And it is the patients who are attributed to that, or the patients who select Vivity, will pick a primary care physician, and this is an HMO product. And the professional services will be capitated to the medical group that they've chosen. And the institutional fund is shared, but it is then dispersed, if there's any money left over, based on quality. Okay. So we put in some requirements that we expect for quality service and patient satisfaction for both the professional side as well as for the institutional side. So the hospitals have to perform, the physicians have to perform, in order for the system to get a percentage of the savings that might be there.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Solomon. Yeah. Good answer.
And that reminds me, so I want to just, one of the interesting things, we were talking about quality metrics earlier, and it is very difficult to define quality, and there's a big debate because there are two different ways of looking at quality metrics. One is, what is the result? And two is, did you do the work needed? Because if you have a very complicated population, you may work hard to get their medical, their chronic diseases under control and not be able to due to, you know, if you're in an inner city, you have a lot of patients who have, you know, if there's poverty, if there's a food deserts and they are not able to help, if transportation problems, you may do everything you can and you may do all the right things, but still not be able to achieve a quality outcome score. If you look at outcomes, equivalent to another area which is more affluent where people, where the systems don't necessarily do the work. On the other hand, if you do the work and you don't have the outcomes, where's the value?
Yeah.
So there's this long-standing debate on which, you know, are they process measures or outcomes measures, which are better. And historically, each health plan had their own quality metrics. Many years ago, IHA got together and helped bring the health plans together and say, we're going to define what the quality metrics are for all of the managed care lives in the state of California, so that all of these managed care groups no longer had to think of all these quality metrics for here, these quality metrics for this plan, this quality metrics for this plan. They can just be one set of metrics. And that had been working well. With this growth of ACOs, now all of a sudden we're sort of back to where we were before, where we have this variety of metrics that vary from ACO to ACO. So for our next generation ACO, which is a Medicare ACO, they have this long list of metrics that we need to hit, which is actually different than our STAR measures for our Medicare Advantage patients. And then for our Anthem ACO, for example, we have another set of quality metrics. For Aetna, we have another set of quality metrics. And then in addition, another thing which we didn't talk about is we are the preferred partner for Boeing in Southern California. And Boeing has another set of quality metrics that they use for each of their organizations as well. So we have well over 100 different quality metrics for a variety of different plans, and it's becoming challenging, or it is challenging, just to figure out how do we implement processes to make sure that the right population is getting these right metrics not only done, but also monitored and measured so that we can report on them at the end of the time period that we're due.
How do you even go about that? I mean, that just seems like a monumental task. How do you go about trying to reconcile that so that your physicians can still do their job effectively and, you know, your care teams can do that and the patient isn't affected, you know, their care, they still receive the same care. How do you go about reconciling those kinds of things?
So it's a tremendous challenge. And for us, it's a relatively new one again. We had gotten very comfortable with the Integrated Healthcare Association measures, the IHA measures, and had systems in place where that data could be pulled in relatively easily and we could put out reports so that the physicians would know who are the patients that have not had the appropriate screenings done, which are the kids that didn't get their vaccines, provide those lists to the physicians, make sure the patients got their metrics taken care of, and had great quality scores. Now the metrics are coming in from different places. We are not as easily able to just pull it out of our system. You have to identify which are the right patients and which are the right metrics. So this is where some of the newer technology is coming in. We've had to implement for our next generation ACO and our Boeing ACO a product that is a database that is able to use applications to pull out the data that we need to make it usable.
So does it interface with like your EMR and to be able to pull that data out? Is that kind of how it works to pull the information it needs?
So in an ideal world, one EMR would talk to another EMR.
Yes.
We'd all be connected.
Yes.
And that adds another layer. So if you think about it, our hospitals and our medical group are all on one EMR, Epic. Mm-hmm. Whereas on our IPA side, they're independent physicians. The Greater Newport physicians did offer them NextGen, which mm-hmm. is another EMR. It's a very popular EMR. And many of them are on NextGen, but others are on other EMRs. We still have a few physicians who are still on paper. So you can't easily pull all that data in. We set up processes for our managed care patients to be able to collect that data or for them to be able to readily submit the data. On the ACO side, the health plan is the one that's paying for everything. So now it's shifted. For us, we can get some of the data because we were paying for it on the managed care side. On the ACO side, we don't have that data. We're not paying for things. So the health plans are giving us that data. So when that data comes in from outside, again, it's only claims data. So that is missing some things that may be done that the health plan doesn't pay for. So sometimes, for example, eye exams may be a carve out. The health plan may not pay for those. Or potentially the patient's been with this health plan for 3 years, but colon cancer screening, if you had a colonoscopy that was clear, would be good for 10 years. That clinical data is not in the claims data set. That claims data, or that clinical data, is in the EMR,
right,
or in the patient or the physician's record. So the database needs to be able to take in all of those disparate data sources, put them together, and then be able to present them. So we're in the process of setting up those mechanisms within our new database product in order to be able to provide that information for our PPO patients the same way as we historically did it for our HMO patients.
Yeah. And that was actually a great segue into what I wanted to ask next about, which is technology. We like to talk to people about the way that technology is affecting their day-to-day lives here. So for you in your job, what is the advance of technology doing? And then also on a healthcare, on a larger healthcare scale, are there any technologies that you're particularly excited about that are maybe coming out now or maybe in the works?
Well, so one of the things that we've done historically is leveraged our EMR on the medical group side, as well as on the IPA side. With Epic, we've implemented some tools to help guide clinical care, not just for the quality metrics, but also the opposite. So there is a set of guidelines called Choosing Wisely, where different medical organizations came out and said, these things are generally not value add. They are things that increase risks to patients without benefit, or maybe increase cost to the system without benefit. And so many of those we've implemented into Epic. So if a physician were to order, say, an x-ray on a patient who comes in with just plain old low back pain, they'll get a warning. There's really no value to doing that imaging if the patient doesn't have a what they call a red flag, something that signifies there's something more significant going on. That's just an example.
Sure.
So using that kind of tool helps to make sure that patients get the right care. In addition, both Epic and NextGen have a portal, so the patients are able to email their physician. They're able to go in there and look up their labs, look up their problem lists. For an Epic, our patients are actually able to schedule an appointment with a physician that they've seen before. Instead of having to call the office and schedule another appointment, they can get in and just do it online, just as you would buy a plane ticket to someplace.
Sure.
So that's been excellent. We've used telemedicine in the system. So our hospital in Fountain Valley, Orange Coast Memorial, is not a pediatric hospital, but we do have a pediatric hospital in Long Beach. And so if a child with a medical need shows up in Orange Coast where the emergency department is not necessarily comfortable with immediately taking care of the patient, besides, you know, if the stabilization is fine, but ongoing care, they are able to access specialists up at Miller Children's Hospital and in real time use telemedicine to help make sure that the kids get the right kind of care.
Yeah. And so obviously all of this comes back to the patient. We talk about a lot of the technical things and, you know, the differences in where technology is going and some of the challenges that are created by in the modern day system. But what overall, all of these things working on the back end, what has it meant for the patient experience?
It's interesting. We keep thinking of the benefits of all this technology. And I think a great example is just that what people think of when they think of telemedicine, the idea that you can get on your computer and go have instead of going to the doctor's office, see the doctor on your computer and get taken care of that way. And there's a lot of excited talk about it. And we've looked into implementing it. But with our research, we found that the uptake is extremely low. So even though it is pushed by some systems, less than 3% of the patients who could use or who would have access to telemedicine actually do it. Most of the time, it ends up being a telephone call or potentially a visit. And even visiting another organization that has a lot of managed care business where they're all prepaid and the patients, you know, are enclosed into one system, they, even though they have it available, again, they've found it's nearly never used. Patients still tend to use the telephone or, again, email the doctor, come in for visits.
Yeah. And so we're just about out of time here. So thank you again for sitting down with us. But just asking you to kind of pull out your crystal ball here. We've noticed a lot of merging of health systems as they're trying to cope with the modern environment and also the growth of IPAs and different organizations like that. If you had to take a peek 5 or 10 years down the road, what do you think the health system will look like? Will it be less but much larger systems? Will IPAs continue to flourish? What do you see happening over the next few years?
I think there are a lot of pressures on IPAs and physicians, independent physicians. One of the things we've had as a goal is really to support the independent practice of medicine, but it is becoming more and more challenging. The costs are going up, the reimbursement is going down, and the expectations for data and management is just increasing exponentially. In addition, physicians coming out of training are not so interested in going out and putting out a shingle and opening their own office and running an office. You do not get any training in how to run an office in medical school. And so as independent physicians age, many of them are not being replaced by new graduates coming out. The other thing that inhibits that is, you know, you come out of training and you start to work, there's no revenue. You don't have any patients. Right. So for a physician to bring in a new colleague, they will have to fund that colleague. And so basically you take your salary, cut it in half for the next, you know, period of time,
right,
until eventually this person becomes independent and starts to be able to bring in enough revenue for themselves. And then where does that leave you down the line? Except, well, now I have somebody to take over my practice. I just paid for somebody to right, take over my right practice. I think with enough support, IPAs can continue to survive. I think they do need to have some alignment with a system that values the contribution of having an independent physician association, that gives them the support to for the contracts and the management of those contracts, to provide the data, to digest the data, and give it to the physician in a format where they can do something with it to make sure that their patients are getting the kinds of outcomes that is expected to maintain the contract. But I do think it is going to be a struggle. And I think not just for the independent physicians, but for many IPAs that don't have organizational structures that support this growth in ACOs and PPO line of business, they're going to go out and either just dissolve or be acquired by larger organizations that have that infrastructure around.
Yeah, excellent.
Ultimately, I think this move towards population-based care and having the organization take on that risk is going to continue for some time. What it looks like, I'm not sure. I think we've got this HMO product where the organization can direct the care of patients and authorize or not authorize them to get care in a narrow network. Some patients love it. Some patients don't. But it is not the be-all and end-all. And on the other side, we have this ACO thing, which has been growing, where you have some of those mechanics, you have some of that ability to help guide patients, support patients, give them additional benefits that they might not get otherwise. But there's only so much you can do. They're still free to go and do what they want. And those expenses may not come down as rapidly. So somewhere in the middle where you have an organization that really is responsible and where there's a collaboration between the patients or potentially the employer and the organization to help keep those patients, employees, healthy, at work, out of the hospital, that's where things are going to go, similar to what we're doing with Boeing. Sure. We are responsible for helping to keep their patients, their employees healthy, and we are at risk, even though we're not capitated, we don't get the money in advance. We help to guide it in the care, and at the end, if there's any money left over, we've reduced the costs that Boeing has to pay, we get to share in some of that savings.
Excellent.
Very good. Well, Dr. Adam Solomon of the Memorial Care Medical Foundation has been our guest. Dr. Solomon, thanks so much for joining us, a wealth of information. And how can folks learn more about Memorial Care Medical Foundation?
If they go on to the web and simply look up Memorial Care, they'll come to the memorialcare.org website and can learn all about us.
Very good. Well, I actually saw Dr. Solomon a few months ago at the CAPG conference. So a quick shout out to Don Crane for the invite to be a guest at the conference and hear from great speakers like yourself, Dr. Solomon. Appreciate you being on the show. And again, folks, if you like our show and want to hear from future guests like Dr. Adam Solomon, please feel free to leave a review on iTunes or on Stitcher. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.